patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch will pull away from the garment, making the tear worse. Neither do men pour new wine into old wineskins. If they do, the skins will burst. The wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved. While he was saying this, a ruler came and knelt before him and said, "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her, and she will live." Jesus got up and went with him, and so did the disciples. Just then, a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak. She said to herself, "If I only touch his cloak, I will be healed." Jesus turned and saw her. "Take heart, daughter," he said. "Your faith has healed you." And the woman was healed from that moment. When Jesus entered the ruler's house and saw the flute players and the noisy crowd, he said, "Go away. The girl is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took the girl by the hand, and she got up. News of this spread through all the region. As Jesus went on from there, two blind men followed him, calling out, "Have mercy on us, Son of David." When he had gone indoors, the blind men came to him, and he asked them, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" "Yes, Lord," they replied. Then he touched their eyes and said, "According to your faith, will it be done to you?" And their sight was restored. Jesus warned them sternly, "See that no one knows about this." But they went out and spread the news about him all over that region. While they were going out, a man who was demon-possessed and could not talk was brought to Jesus. And when the demon was driven out, the man who had been mute spoke. The crowd was amazed and said, "Nothing like this has ever been seen in Israel." But the Pharisee said, "It is by the prince of demons that he drives out demons." This is the word of the Lord.
"You got to have faith," so sang George Michael. Hands up if you own the song. Hands up if you've sung to it, if you've driven along in your car. Yes, a few true believers. You got to have faith. But what is faith? What does faith do? What is it about faith that makes it important or indeed makes it work? Is it sincerity? Well, sincerity is good, but you can be sincerely wrong. Is it the strength of your faith? I can have strong faith that leprechauns live in Asquith and come out to play after midnight. But how many are going to believe me on that one? No doubt people say to you, as they say to me, "I wish I had your faith." But what are they actually saying? They may admire the fact that you have a purpose for living, that you have something to believe in, that you can believe things that they just can't. But Hitler had a purpose for living. Or Pol Pot. And they had causes that they believed in. Well, maybe, yes, you've got to have faith, but not just faith in anything. Well, we return this morning to our series in Matthew's Gospel and chapter 9 from verse 14. And we see, first of all, in verses 14 to 17, the time for faith. We have been seeing in our series that we must understand the times. And from verse 14, we see that it is a time when Messiah has come. We read, "Then John's disciples came and asked him, 'How is it that we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast?' Jesus answered, 'How can the guests of the bridegroom mourn while he is with them? The time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them. Then they will fast. No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, for the patch will pull away from the garment, making the tear worse. Neither do people pour new wine into old wineskins. If they do, the skins will burst. The wine will run out and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved. John's disciple said, "How is it that we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples don't fast?" Jesus' disciples were feasting, not fasting. That's because the bridegroom is with them. You do not mourn or fast while he is with you. Hosea had prophesied that in the day when Messiah comes, that you will call the Lord my husband. In Jesus, that day had arrived. The bridegroom was with them. Understand the times. The bridegroom has arrived. The bridegroom is here. Jesus goes on to say that you don't sew a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. Understand the times. The old system of Judaism has had its day. It wasn't a bad system, but its function had come to an end because it pointed to Jesus, and Jesus was now here. He was now on the scene. He is not to be tacked on to the old system of Judaism. He came to bring a whole new age. From verse 17, we read that you don't pour new wine into old wineskins. The new vintage has been brought into the world. You cannot put that into the old wineskin of Old Testament Judaism. What they were preparing for has come. A new authority has come into this world. A new power has arrived, one like the world has never seen before, one with authority and power to put all things right and to forgive sins. Understand the times. And so we are starting to see the importance of faith, that what matters is not the one holding faith, but the object of one's faith. What, or more to the point, who we put our faith in must be true. Only biblical faith, the faith that understands that Jesus was the promised Messiah who came with all the authority and power of God and then hangs on to him no matter what, that is the faith that counts. You see, secondly, in verses 18 to 19, an example of strong faith. While he was saying this, a synagogue leader came and knelt before him and said, "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her and she will live." Jesus got up and went with him, and so did his disciples. Matthew here describes in his typical brevity a tragic scene. The death of a young girl. In Mark's gospel, we discover that she was only 12 years of age. I heard a radio interview recently of a mother who had lost a child, and she said that if you lose a parent, you have lost your past, but that if you lose a child, you have lost your future. And so it may well seem. And in hearing of this death, we can sense the grief and the sense of futility and wasted possibility. In case we are not sure that she really was dead, the recording of official mourners being present tells us that she was. Also, the response of derision when Jesus said that she wasn't dead, only sleeping, also confirms this fact. Now, Jesus' comment about sleep is not to be taken that he really thought she was asleep, but that to Jesus, with all his power and authority, raising a person from death was like waking a person up from sleep. Indeed, for those of us with teenage daughters, we might note that Jesus performed his task with considerably greater ease. And this is once more evidence of the new era that Jesus had come to usher in. He is the King with all of God's absolute authority, even over death. In imploring Jesus, this ruler demonstrated strong faith. The description of coming and kneeling before Jesus uses the very same word that Matthew used to describe the worship of the Magi back in chapter 2. Like the eastern kings before him, this ruler came into the house and knelt and spoke. And in this action, we see once more that it is the object of our faith that counts. This ruler was not putting his faith in someone that was a fraud. Now, I don't know about you, but I've never quite been able to work out the wizard in The Wizard of Oz. His character has always puzzled me and disturbed me. But when Dorothy goes through such a great ordeal to get to the wizard in order to get back to Kansas and then discovers that he is no real wizard with no real power, that's a disturbing moment in the movie. It was to me as a young child, and it still is when I watch that movie. If you've got any light to shed on that one, please tell me at morning tea. But what this ruler discovered, though, is that his faith was not just in some trickster. This Jesus that he implores to heal his daughter is no other than the one with all the authority of God himself. Indeed, he has authority even over our greatest enemy, death. And so surely there can be no other appropriate response than to worship. To place one's faith in the one who has come to usher in a new era where death will be defeated once and for all. Before this scene comes to its conclusion, however, there is an interruption, and we see in verses 20 to 21 what we might call superstitious faith. We read from verse 20, "Just then a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak. She said to herself, 'If I only touch his cloak, I will be healed.'" This woman had suffered for 12 long years. If the bleeding was from her womb, then according to Jewish law, she would have been considered unclean for all that time. That would mean that she shouldn't have even been in this crowd, where she would be contaminating others. And one thing for sure, she shouldn't be reaching out to touch Jesus. We see too that her brazen faith was mixed with superstition. She thinks that touching a piece of cloth, if I can only touch his garment, I'll be healed. Regardless of this though, her faith is honoured and she is healed. Indeed, Jesus draws attention to her faith, verse 22. "Take heart, daughter," he said, "your faith has healed you." And the woman was healed at that moment. Here we are starting to see that even an imperfect faith can bring results. Why? Well, once again, it has to do with the object of one's faith. She had one thing right. It was Jesus and Jesus only who could heal her. By the way, it's nice, don't you think, that Jesus calls her daughter? The one who was an outcast, the one that had been considered unclean for 12 long years, Jesus had rescued her from the isolation of spiritual and physical condemnation, enabling her to be welcomed back amongst God's people as a full member of God's family. No longer is she an outcast, but a daughter. The narrative then returns to the conclusion of the story of the synagogue leader's daughter, and we read in verse 25, "After the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took the girl by the hand, and she got up." This really is God's long-promised king who reigns eternally and defeats death forever. This is the one of which Isaiah prophesied in chapter 25, verse 8, that he will swallow up death forever and wipe away all tears. In this healing, we have a foretaste of that. We saw last week that Jesus had arrived early in one sense, that he had come to do away with that, and here we have a prelude to where he will do that forever. And for us who live in our times, who know that Jesus' overcoming death happened even more decisively in the resurrection, know that one day our greatest enemy will be defeated. Everything that wrecks and spoils all our hopes and dreams in this world will be done away with forever. He has absolute power to summon even the dead from their sleep. So for those of us who are grieving, those of us who are touched by death, let us take hope. Be assured, friends, that death is not the end. That one day all of God's people will be raised and will reign with him forever. Well, we turn next in our passage to what we can call seeing faith or informed faith. In verse 27 we read, as Jesus went on from there, two blind men followed him, calling out, have mercy on us, son of David. As with the leper in chapter 8, the presence of two blind men in God's promised land, where God's blessings were meant to be experienced in abundance, is evidence that all is not well in Israel. But in Isaiah 35, it was promised that with the coming of the Messiah, that the eyes of the blind shall be opened. It was prophesied that that would happen. And once again, we see in this healing that in Jesus, God's promised King has arrived. Let's take a moment, though, to reflect on the nature of their faith. Firstly, let us see the way they address Jesus, son of David. They are identifying Jesus as the long-awaited Messiah King, the way Matthew addresses him way back in chapter 1. Now, these guys could not see, but they had 20/20 vision when it came to understanding who Jesus was. Their assessment of him, based no doubt on the prophecies of the Old Testament and what they had seen in his actions, were right on the money. And once again we see that the object of one's faith is what matters. If Jesus wasn't the son of David, if he wasn't the promised Messiah who had come to overcome death, then their faith would have been of little use. No more help than me believing that leprechauns lived in my garden and that they were going to do my gardening for me next week. In verse 28, Jesus asked them, do you believe that I am able to do this? Yes, Lord, they replied. And then he touched their eyes and said, according to your faith, let it be done to you. And their sight was restored. Now, that doesn't mean that they had 100% faith, and if they only had 60% faith, they'd only have 60% of their sight restored. No, they had faith, and so according to that, they were healed. It was consistent with their faith. They believed that Jesus could restore their sight, and so Jesus responds by healing them according to that faith. Well, yes, you gotta have faith. George got it right. But here we've seen strong faith, superstitious faith, and seeing faith. In previous weeks, we saw the bankrupt faith of the disciples on the boat. And in the centurion, amazing faith in believing that all Jesus had to do was to say the word and his servant would be healed. In case you haven't got the point already, one needs faith, but what matters is not the subject of faith, the one exercising the faith, but the object of our faith. Faith in and of itself, irrespective of its object, does nothing. The faith that saves is the faith whose object is Jesus. In reality, it is Jesus who saves and not our faith. All the examples we have seen today and in previous weeks were effective because, not in and of that faith itself, but because of who they had put their faith in. Yes, we must exercise faith. But you've got to get the object right. All in one way or another, irrespective of strong or weak or informed or superstitious, had their faith in Jesus. Now I want you to imagine, and you'll need to really imagine this, that I go to my garage and I get out a few bits of wood and I get a few nails and a hammer and I start hammering together and I make a nice chair. Yes, that really requires faith to believe that someone like me could do that. By the by. And then one of my daughters comes along and I say to her, look at the chair that I've just made. Do you believe that that chair is going to hold you up? well, why don't you go and sit in it for me? And she says, oh, Dad, you made it. That's fantastic. I'm sure it can hold me up. She walks over and sits in it and wriggles around. Says, this is a great chair, Dad. Then she goes off. And then a more informed, perhaps, daughter of mine comes along and she looks at it and she looks at me and she says, I know what you're like, Dad, with a hammer and nail. I've seen you whack that thumb more than one time. I'm not really sure it can hold me up. I've got my doubts, but I'll give it a go. I'll trust you on this one. So she sits in the chair and she's a bit nervous and she doesn't want to move too much, but it holds her up too. Whose faith was effective? The one that really believed or the one who doubted? Well, the answer is both, of course, because they were willing to exercise their faith and put their trust in that chair. It was the chair's ability to hold them up that really mattered. So, friends, where we direct our faith is what is important. Don't worry so much whether your faith be weak or strong. By all means, ask God to increase your faith and keep trusting him. But make sure that your faith is in Jesus. Your faith must be grounded in the one who came to usher in the new era, the one who came as the promised Messiah, the one who came to do away with death forever. Faith in anything or anyone else is futile faith. True faith is based on the historical fact of Jesus Christ that we can read in Matthew and the other Gospels as well. Lewis Carroll, in his book Through the Looking Glass, writes of how the White Queen asks Alice to believe that she is just 101, 5 months and a day. When Alice protests at being asked to believe something so ridiculous, the Queen replies, try again, take a long breath, and shut your eyes. Alice is not persuaded. One can't believe impossible things, she says. To which the Queen replies, I dare say you haven't had much practice. When I was your age, I always did it for half an hour a day. Why, sometimes I've believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast. True biblical faith is not a matter of immature children believing 6 impossible things before breakfast. True biblical faith comes as we look closely at the evidence and take appropriate action. It is responding appropriately to the truths revealed in Jesus Christ. And furthermore, such faith comes as a gift from God. It is God who gives spiritual sight to the spiritual blind. We won't be able to work it out on our own. So if you think as you look at others around you, I wish I had their faith, then ask God to give you that faith and go and look at the evidence. Ask him that as you do so, he will give you spiritual understanding and that he will take the scales from your eyes and enable you to see. And indeed, that must be the prayer for those around us as we want to reach our community for Christ. Pray that he will give them the gift of faith and that he will enable them to see. For we see, lastly, faith demanded. One still needs to make a decision to exercise faith. The coming of the king brings division. Yes, there is a decision to be made. In verse 32, we read of a man who was demon-possessed and mute, was brought to Jesus, and Jesus heals him. 2 different responses are recorded. The crowd was amazed and said, "Nothing like this has ever been seen in Israel." But verse 34, the Pharisees said, "It is by the prince of demons that he drives out demons." They refused to believe despite the evidence. They refused to put their faith in the one that it is worth putting your faith in. Yes, you've got to have faith. Do you have it? You've got to have faith in Jesus. Do you? Can you see, or are you still spiritually blind? Let me pray. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you that in the coming of Jesus, it was the coming of the bridegroom, the coming of the Messiah, the coming of your King, who was ushering in a new era. The time when the one who could overcome death was breaking through. And we pray, Father, that we might remember this morning that we have to have faith, but that we have to have it in your Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. May each of us put our place our faith and trust in him, not on a whim, but because of the historical fact of the death and resurrection of him. And Lord, for those of us who are touched